Non-stop information for the country and community on what's the 411 with the award-winning Sharon Kay.
You're so good. Truly. You know, you wonder for like him and others that have done this for a long time, that you get up at the crack of dawn.
That's right.
Aren't you glad to have a day off?
Yeah, you can get one, yeah.
Yeah, to sleep late. And do you actually sleep late? It's hard, isn't it?
It is.
After you're clocking.
Yeah.
Your body clock, except for when you have to wake up, then your body clock is like,
yeah.
I don't want to. Anyway, hello, Nashville. All the wonderful and lovely people that are up early percolating. There's a lot of y'all up. And sun is up. Everybody's moving at their own pace this morning. Going to work or, you know, getting ready for your day. So happy to have you tuning in and finding this broadcast on WFSK. And today, Black History Month, first Sunday, right? Isn't today the 6th, right?
Yes, it's first Sunday.
First Sunday in Black History Month. And we can still call it that. We're 6 days in and nobody's bandaged yet. Well, we hope that, you know, that this doesn't, you know, don't give anybody any ideas. Anyway, we have news from the community today that is actually local, but the person is not. That is, it's connected to local. The person that I'll be talking to is going to bring us the news from the community today. That'll be at 7:30, and this is Black History Month information that I hope that you stay tuned and hear what she's going to be talking about, particularly if you are United Methodist. Anyway, 8 o'clock, new guest, Dr. Christina Edmondson. She is co-author of Faithful Anti-Racism, Moving Past Talk to Systemic Change. And oh, for the days when you can just move past all of that talk and get down to business. Anyway, how was your weekend? Quiet? Went by too fast, though, didn't it?
Yeah. Really quick.
Yeah, just like, boom, it's gone. But it's always good to have some time to exhale, unwind, that type of thing. Anyway, you ready for next weekend, or are you hyped, or are you going to be, you know?
It's going to be a different Super Bowl. I'm glad to see two teams that haven't been in a while and a different kind of game. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
But I think most eyes are going to be on the halftime show.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, because the lineup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Dre put together, I think, Mary J. Blige, Snoop Dogg, and who else is on there? I can't think of who else is on that lineup.
Well, it'll be people that he knows, and then knows well. And a lot of eyes will be on it. I'm not going to just sit there and dwell, because I have no reason to this year. I'm not I don't have a personal favorite or anything like that. Yeah. Are you pulling for one versus the other?
Probably the Rams more so, because I want to see Odell Beckham get a ring. So, yeah. Yeah.
You want to see him get a ring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's one of the receivers on the team who is an interesting person.
Deserves it? Is that what you mean?
He's gone through a lot of adversity in terms of his career and trying to get to where he's at, and then he was, he had to somehow negotiate this trade from Cleveland about maybe a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, after riding the bench for half the, this is a lot of controversy, but to see him get to where he's at now, it's a good thing to see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. Yeah. Well, we can talk about it then.
Yeah.
After. And then you'll probably have to fill me in, because I doubt very seriously.
You doubt your wife.
Yeah, I'm just, I'm not interested. I mean, I am, but I'm not. And I'm not being a sour fan of one of the teams that didn't make it. But it is what it is. The WFSK's special Black History Month programming started on Thursday at 7, and the next one airs tomorrow evening at 7. And be sure to tune in this month. We have about 8 different segments for you. 1 hour is devoted to these specials, and on a host of topics, and Black History Month programming on WFSK this year is brought to you in part by the Frist Art Museum, so we thank them for their support of that particular programming. And speaking of the Frist, on Wednesday, this Wednesday, there's an exhibit that is debuting, Alexander Bryant's exhibit.
Okay.
And he'll be on Wednesday to talk about it, and along with Katie Del May of the Frist. And that's one of several that, but that's in particular, he'll share with the audience about himself, and because he's not a native of the city, and talk about that and what all's in the exhibit. And I heard when they had the preview, it was packed. People really wanted to see what he had, and they came out and they had a very nice crowd. So hopefully that will be the case for this particular exhibit. And got a few headlines, and what else is going on besides Black History Month stuff?
There's a lot going on. It just depends on where you wanted to start.
Well, that's true. Let me just start with the headlines.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Out of Nashville, jurors refused to make parole possible after 51 years in prison for the man who shot and killed 4 people at a Nashville Waffle House in 2018. Yesterday, the jurors deliberated the fate of 33-year-old Travis Reinking after hearing family members of the 4 people killed testify. They sobbed and trembled as they talked about their loved ones and how losing them continues to fracture their lives more than 3 years later. Jurors on Friday rejected Ryan King's insanity defense as they found him guilty on 16 charges, including 4 counts of first-degree murder. Prosecutors were not seeking the death penalty. I am very glad that case is over.
Yeah.
And that those family members got to speak their heart and thoughts out to the public the way that they did, to talk about their children and that the jury made the decisions that it made, because that young man put absolute terror in the hearts of so
many.
Yes,
he did.
So we are not interested in seeing him again out and about on the streets. So, and I just, you know, you continue to keep the families in prayer and in your thoughts, because they're going to be dealing with the loss of their loved ones now for the rest of their lives. And I know they had a slight sense of relief yesterday, although their loved ones won't be able to be with them, but just in spirit. And that brings that sad story to an end. And also out of Nashville, Governor Bill Lee strikes again. His authoritarian wings. He says he supports placing more scrutiny over school libraries so that students consume age-appropriate content. The Republicans' remarks came less than a week after a local Tennessee school board attracted national attention for banning a Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel about the Holocaust. Across the country, conservative officials are increasingly attempting to limit the exposure of certain books to children, particularly books that touch on structural racism and LGBTQ issues. Lee has filed a separate bill that would require school libraries to post their content online and regularly view these policies to make sure the materials are age appropriate for the children assessing them. Now, this is when any and everybody makes their comments, and he's not going to listen to anybody but the comments of the people that agree with him.
Exactly.
And so he don't even know why you're going to put the list up there.
He's not looking for anybody's comments.
No, he's on the trajectory.
Yes, he is.
Of whatever they're doing nationally in the Republican Party, no matter how far out there it is, he is going to ditto. So it'll be ditto, ditto. And I'm waiting for him to say he won't support a black woman as a Supreme Court justice. I'm waiting for that comment to come. I'm waiting. As the rest of them line up to say that it's wrong. Anyway, the bill was filed Monday. So here he goes, more. Mm-hmm. You know what, when with this type of stuff like this, because over the years, you know, all kinds of things have been banned, that just makes people want to read it more.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes them, because, you know, you can try to hide things if you want to.
Do these people ever consider the kind of legacy? In other words,
no.
You know, it seems to me history repeating itself. Part of the reason for this is because you don't want to recognize the people in your family who owned slaves, who were racist and things of this nature.
Or might be LGBTQ.
Yeah. So you don't want to recognize them because, I don't know, shame maybe. So you don't feel in the next couple of years, it doesn't take that long, that you're going to be tied into the same type of behavior and same type of thing. Because things change. Things change. So the things that they're doing now, they don't care about how history is going to treat them
later.
It
repeats itself,
yeah.
Is what it does.
So he doesn't care about how his legacy as the governor is going to be in his legislature.
He's not concerned about that.
Okay.
This, I mean, when I said ditto,
right.
I mean ditto.
Yeah.
If you see what is going on in other states, Texas and Florida and places of that nature, then everything that they say and do, expect it to be here.
Yeah.
So when you see them make a move,
he's
going to move just like that. Yep. And everything that
it's a song, by the way.
I know. I speak in song here. But that is, if you just can watch how his blueprint that he's leaving out here is so obvious, because it just takes a couple of weeks.
It's going to follow you, buddy. We're going to be talking about you and your legacy and the things that you did to destroy this state soon.
People are going to forget.
Oh, no, they want history. They'll be, because In other words, you're not he's not going to have power forever.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. History that you're allowed to hear.
Oh.
That won't be banned.
Oh.
Okay.
You know what? It won't be banned. It'll still reflect who you are, sir.
Well,
and it will follow you.
Telling you. Mm-hmm. That the folks that want to ban everything can certainly ban their own mess.
Look at the statue that finally came down. You see what I'm saying? It may not happen right away, but it shall happen.
And then if it's banned, it just goes to the ban list.
Yeah.
You know, books like The Color Purple.
He's going to go down as one of the governors of Tennessee that was one of the worst. He is.
Well, for those that love him, they think he's the best.
Yeah. They'll love him now.
Well.
They'll love him now. Because the very thing that people are not calculating on, and this is something my sister talked about, thank you, IKEA, is that more and more people are moving to Tennessee, and more people are moving to some of these rural areas, and they're not Republicans. So at some point,
that
I don't care how much,
that we know,
because
you don't know.
But nonetheless, it's still going to be a mixture, because it's not going to stay the same. A lot of people are migrating to this state. And things are changing slowly but surely. And so, you know, you can gerrymander all you want. You're gonna gerrymander yourself into a box. But that's okay.
And that very well may be the case, but this state has a complete and total history of being just like it is. Just exactly like it is. Some stuff has changed, but
some things do stay the same, but that's okay.
And it took 10 years to undo this district.
That's okay.
To divide Nashville into three pieces.
That's okay.
I just know that that's going to be a hot mess.
Yes, it sure is.
When the time comes out, it's just going to be a hot mess.
It sure is.
So we'll have to see how that goes and what books are going to be next. Wasn't that the governor of Virginia that just, I think he did some banning of some things?
Yeah.
And he wanted a tattletale list. So,
how was affecting
Governor
the teachers? Teachers don't want to teach now. They're leaving the field. I mean, okay, yep, keep it up.
Well, Governor Lee wants a list online so you can do what I... Ditto, Virginia. Not send an email, just, you know.
Harass and slander.
Comments. Put your comments down.
Yeah.
And, but it's all that does is just make kids want to go.
Yeah. This coming
go
from a,
somewhere.
This
and
coming
just
from
read
a guy.
It. I mean, you know.
This coming from a guy who won't meet with any of the urban media or newspaper or anything else. He won't meet with us.
He's not thinking about you.
But he'll do that to other people.
He's not thinking about you.
All right. What's that doing to others? Okay.
He's not. You tripping. Because that is not happening.
Yeah, that's
is not happening.
That's okay.
That's absolutely
God
not happening.
God sees all.
And, it's not happening. I mean, just that you might as well forget it.
Yeah.
Because that's not happening. But I'm just, you know, to me, it's like a lot of the books, you know, like if your parents growing up said, don't be doing this and don't be doing that, it made you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It made you want to, you know, don't be peeking and sneaking and all that.
It wakes
and,
up those
and
sleeping
giants,
by the way.
And doggone if you don't do it. And a lot of those books that have been banned over the years became number one bestsellers. So, and as they did that, the authors made more and more money. So, I mean, you know, who you hurting? Anyway, let's take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Hey there, Christian McBride here, host of Jazz Night in America. We're kicking off this year's Black History Month with a rebroadcast of an episode profiling my piece, The Movement Revisited. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Catch Jazz Night in America every Sunday from 2 to 3 p.m. and Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here at listener-supported Jazzy 88.
Support for WFSK comes from the United Way of Greater Nashville. Don't pay to have your taxes filed. United Way's Vita-Free Tax Prep Program can help. Visit UnitedWayFileFree.com or call 211 to have your taxes filed in person or virtually by IRS-certified preparers. That's UnitedWayFileFree.com or 211.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind. Like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. But pre-diabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop pre-diabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control. So you're on your own with the wasps. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its pre-diabetes awareness partners.
Veterans, you may have earned a variety of VA benefits. Did you know VA can help you further your education and pursue professional training? The Home Loan Guarantee Program can help you buy, repair, or adapt a home. VA provides housing support if you find yourself homeless or at risk of homelessness. And don't forget, world-class health care. Learn more about these and other VA benefits. Visit choose.va.gov.
This has been a reminder from community-minded Jazzy 88 WFSK.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
Already Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on. Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic. Fisk University. And a couple more stories before we go to the news from the community. The uproar over Whoopi Goldberg's remarks about the Holocaust has catalyzed some somber reflections by many American Jews, and not just about the Holocaust legacy. They also have recalled anti-Jewish discrimination in the United States and pondered the Jewish community's sense of collective identity. Goldberg said this week on The View, last week, rather, that the Nazis' genocide wasn't about race. She soon apologized for failing to acknowledge that the Nazis considered Jews as an inferior race. Jewish leaders are noting the complexity of describing how race fits into the concept of Jewish identity. They say it entails a mix of religion, nationality, ethnicity, culture, and history. And as soon as she said it, I knew that she was in trouble. So Whoopi should not, you know, that one she should not have said at all. I just don't know how you could think it's not about race when they were considered as an inferior race.
Yeah.
I don't know. But she has learned.
Yeah.
You know, a certain area you just don't mess with.
Just think about Jesse Owens. what he did to Hitler. So, yeah.
What does that have to do with what I'm talking about?
Because one of the things that really stuck it to Hitler.
Jesse Owens is black.
Exactly.
Okay.
But we're talking about race. And so.
No, I'm talking about Jewish.
Now, yeah.
Don't fall in.
I get that part.
Okay.
But I'm tying that to Whoopi because she's old enough to remember Jesse Owens. And the fact that...
She's old enough to remember a lot of things.
Exactly.
Like the people that she works for and where she is and how life is. She's old enough to know.
Yeah.
But maybe she didn't know. Because sometimes people don't know things. You know, they just make an assumption. Because she was basing it on, when I see you, what color you are.
I get that.
She wasn't basing it on... And when
I heard her comment.
When she made the comment, that's what she was referring to. Yeah. And then she came back on Colbert.
That's what got her in trouble, yeah.
When she said that, and that to me, as that analogy, I mean, you know, just talking about it, period, for her was not going to be good. But I understood what she was saying when she said that. But I just feel like, you know, when we ban things and hide things from people and don't teach them about race and culture, this is what you have.
That's what you get.
You know, so, and maybe they weren't allowed in her school or in her circles to learn, or maybe she may need to take some cross-cultural classes, trainings, or something like that. That would be helpful for the whole country to have anyway, so we can begin to... you know, make some change so people know about each other's races and cultures, because you can't go by how somebody looks for sure. Now, out of Washington, when Ketanji Brown Jackson's younger daughter was 11, she drafted a letter to President Barack Obama suggesting her federal judge mom for vacancy on the Supreme Court. Layla Jackson wrote that her mother is determined, honest, and never breaks a promise to anyone. If there are other things she'd rather do. Judge Jackson didn't get the nod in 2016, but today she's considered among the leading candidates to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer as President Joe Biden seeks to fulfill a campaign pledge to nominate the first black woman to the court. Jackson clerked for Breyer and has had a varied career, including experiences as a public defender that could set her apart. And President Biden's pledge to name a black woman to fill the Supreme Court vacancy has thrust the Republicans into a tricky political calculation, forcing them to confront how aggressive to be in opposing the nominee and how to do so without appearing to be racist and sexist. While Supreme Court battles have become scorched earth affairs in recent years, Republicans are weighing whether to wage all-out war or take a more tempered approach against Mr. Biden's pick, particularly given that whomever the president chooses to succeed Justice Breyer will not change the conservative ideology tilt of the court. Many of them recognize that a divisive fight could provide more fodder for Democrats to try to deepen the wedge between their party and African Americans before this year's midterm elections. And while some take issue with Mr. Biden's preemptive promise to name the first black woman to the court, arguing that the choice should be based on merit rather than race or gender, Republicans enter the coming showdown fully aware that there's black Republican women, that the groundbreaking nature of the president's pick could make it challenging for a nominee, and particularly for a black woman. If the black Republican women don't say anything, okay, wait a minute, I got one more for you, because I know I saw your mouth get right open. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine says the idea that race and gender should be number one and number two criteria is not as it should be, really now. She is regarded as a potential swing vote in favor of Mr. Biden's pick. On the other hand, there are many qualified black women for this post, and given that Democrats, regrettably, have had some success in trying to paint Republicans as anti-black, it may make it more difficult to reject a black jurist. So this could have the opposite effect. But I just want to know, Republican black women, would you just say, oh, okay, that we don't want one either? I mean, really? So, you know, how did Clarence Thomas end up there all these years? So he's a black man because that was the Republican Party at the time was determined to find a black man because there wasn't, hadn't been one since Thurgood Marshall. So knowing that there's a case, this is going to be a rock and a hard place. Yeah, this is going to be a rock and a hard place. So, you know, we'll see if the lockstep, you know, are you going to really throw your people under the bus and, like, you know, like, question these people? I mean, because they're already speaking out all over the country about it. So
it's become a hot potato.
Well, it and for no reason.
Exactly.
You know, you know, why are we even having that discussion? If he's going to, you know, pick, you know, Amy Coney Barrett is a white woman. Nobody was in an uproar about that, okay? Nobody said, oh, you're wrong because you picked a white woman.
Very quickly. What was it, 30 days?
Yeah, I mean, it was just insanity. The whole thing was just nuts. So
because of an op-ed.
And then people talk
and
about...
And didn't answer any questions.
There's no such a thing as systemic racism. Oh, isn't? It isn't. Oh, okay. So having said that, I mean, that for folks on that side of the aisle to object to that because he is fulfilling a promise he made on the trail is ridiculous because that is all that at election time and running up to election time, that's all we hear about is the fulfilled promises of such and such and
such. We heard it last 4 years.
I'm pretty much
promises,
thinking. Promises made, promises kept. So, I mean, you know, it's just like this stuff, you don't even have to be highly educated to see. You could just have a common sense degree.
And the game the Republicans are trying to play is to try to run out the clock and get it in debate so they can argue and pick apart whoever it is. And, you know, so, no, Joe, don't fall for that.
No, and I hope that, you know, they hurry up. And
yeah, get it done.
Yeah, just do it and... Because I, you know, the sisters are saying it's about time, Lord. About time.
It's been about time.
It's past time. And, you know, so, you know, the facts are is that they need to shut that down. Just shut it down. Unless the black Republican women say, oh, okay, it's okay. I just, you know, I'm so curious.
They should have been said, yeah, it's okay, it's okay.
Well, they say that about everything else. No, it's okay to not have one.
Oh.
Okay, that kind of okay. Okay. They say it's okay not to have one. Let me see. That will be a question that they will not want to answer. They'll start talking about Hillary Clinton and, you know, anything other than answer that question. And that's the sad part. Anyway, let's get our news straight and directly from the community. So time will tell on that. From Carol Travis, and we're happy to hear what she's got to say about a heritage center. Always during Black History Month, the listeners of What's the 411 with Sharon Kay know I seek out outlets and events and people, history, legacy, places, things, whatever I can find to make sure that we cover this important month adequately here on the broadcast. And I'm happy to welcome this beautiful and lovely Sunday morning to the show. There is a new center, I guess it's a new center or one that I'm getting familiar with. I want to welcome Carol Travis to the broadcast today. She is the executive assistant to the Board of Trustees of the African American Methodist Heritage Center, Incorporated. Good morning, Carol. How are you?
Good morning, Sharon. I am great. Thank you so much for this opportunity to have a conversation with you. It's been delightful with the work we've done getting up to this call, and I am just happy to be present with you through the airwaves today.
Absolutely. And I know before we get to going, you probably know some folks here in the United Methodist family, and I'm going to let you get your Sunday morning shout-outs on right now. You want to give some sense of love out to some of the folks in Nashville that you may know?
Yes, I want to send a shout-out to some of my friends at Gordon United Methodist Church, Dr. Angela Carfelder, I'm not sure if Reverend Evan Young, Reverend Dr. Evan Young is attending Gordon. I'm trying to think of who else I know there. I believe that Mr. Donnell King may be still attending Gordon. I'm not sure if all of them are still there. Angela, I know, is still there, so I know I can give a shout out to Angela this morning.
All right, and let me just include the entire Gordon Memorial family over there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the pastor at Gordon. And because they have off and on over the years, depending on what it is that they have had for the community. We've had folks to represent that church, which is not too terribly far from historic Fisk University. Now, Carol, as far as the history of this Heritage Center, I love museums and things of that nature, so I'm always looking for places, information places to share with the audience. And that's what caught my eye about this, and in particular for the community of faith that listen to the broadcast on Sunday morning. How did this start? And bring us up to date on where you are with the center, because you have history of working with the center.
Sure, sure. Let me just say, Sharon, that we need to just go back just a little bit and start with the Methodist Church formed in 1784.
Mm-hmm.
And always, race and segregation have been what have divided the church.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that many of the ancestors were slave owners. There was just an article in the Washington Post, which is the major newspaper where I live, right outside of Washington, D.C., that mm-hmm. talked about the number of Congress people through the years who were slave owners. So we've always had an issue of race and segregation. However, in 1939, the Methodist Church created what we call the central jurisdiction. The central jurisdiction was the jurisdiction where all of the black preachers and members of the church were segregated.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, blacks were not seen perhaps as worthy, for want of a better term, to worship alongside of whites in some places. So the central jurisdiction was formed in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
People look back on the central jurisdiction to say, while it was something that was not pleasant that happened to black Methodists at that time, but it really was an opportunity that our ancestors saw to gain leadership skills, to build connections, to really do the kind of work that would establish them to be leaders in their jobs, in their churches. So that was what our heritage was back in 1939.
Mm.
However, in 1968, the central jurisdiction was abolished, and the United Methodist Church was formed. And the United Methodist Church was formed with the Methodist Church and the United Brethren congregation.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how the United Methodist Church was formed in 1968. Also in 1968, a group of blacks, many of them who were active in the central jurisdiction, were concerned that the history of black people in the Methodist Church would be lost.
Mm.
That when the two churches came together, that much of what was done in the central jurisdiction and during the times where blacks were allowed to be active in the church, they were concerned that that history would be lost. So Black Methodists for Church Renewal was formed.
Mm.
That is an organization that still exists today, and it is to ensure that black people are represented at all areas and all places in the United Methodist Church. Around this time, Bishop Farr Stiff, who was a bishop in the Methodist Church, and others got together and decided that there needed to be a place where the history of black Methodists could be recorded, preserved, and protected.
Mm.
That would be established out of Black Methodists for Church Renewal. So based on that, 20 years ago in 2001, we formed the African American Methodist Heritage Center.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me just say, at first, it is not a place that you can go in and visit like you can some of the other large museums.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed to be a place where our records could be restored, protected, and where we could continue to promote the history of blacks in the United Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. Our center is physically located on the campus of Drew University in the United Methodist Institution called the General Commission on Archives and History. Mm-hmm. We found that that was the best place to store our materials. We knew that they would be protected, that the archivists there would be using the white gloves and mm-hmm. all of the other methods mm-hmm. that could be used to preserve the history. So our records are housed at the General Commission on Archives and History. Mm. So we have physically had a presence there for about 10 years, maybe a little bit longer, because when we first started the organization, mm-hmm. I was the first, assistant, if you call it for want of a better term. I shared a church with Bishop Farstith. Both of us attend historic Asbury United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. And I had just retired from Verizon Communications, and I knew that I wanted to do church work. So Bishop tapped me to be the original, recorder of what went on, what transpired. Mm-hmm. And we started to collect artifacts and house them right in a spare place at Asbury United Methodist Church.
What type of artifacts would you have?
Well, yes, I can get into that. Okay. We are interested in records of the central jurisdiction. We're interested in histories. We're interested in sermons of some of our prominent United Methodists. Let me tell you a quick story that I still tell whenever I go out. It involves a gentleman who called me, who lived in, who I'm sure still lives in, New Orleans. And he called me. He said, "Miss Travis, I really have all of my father's materials." And he's a graduate, I can't remember of what school, but let's just say he's a graduate of Fisk University. Mm-hmm. And I really want to send all of his materials. He was a big member, a big contributor to mm-hmm. Fisk University when he was there. And he has all of these records that I don't want to get rid of. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to send, really anything to you. I just want to send something to Fisk. So I said to him, "Sir, it's fine. I really want you to preserve your father's material. But can you just send me something? We don't want it all. We just want some materials that show that your father existed and mm-hmm. the wonderful work that he did." Well, he sent them to me, Sharon. And you know what happened when Katrina came?
Oh, no.
He lost house, car, everything. He called me in tears. He said, "Miss Travis, I'm so happy you convinced me to send you my father's materials mm. because they are the only things that we're able to even know where they are." Mm-mm-mm. Within 2 days, Sharon, we had copied his materials and sent them to him. Mm. So we encourage, and every time I go out, which is normally several times a year before mm-hmm. the pandemic, to talk about our work, we encourage people to go to their basement, to their attics. If they knew the roles that their parents and foreparents played in the establishment of the Methodist Church, mm-hmm. we don't want that lost. Our center is a place where people who are writing books, for example, Angela Kernfelder, who is the daughter of Bishop Leontine Kelly, who was the first African-American woman ordained as a bishop in any denomination. And of course, she was the first black woman ordained in the Methodist Church. Angela went to Drew, up to our center, and did all of her research on what her mother had done and pulled up all of her mother's materials so she could reference. Our archivists in Drew get calls from all across the country. We've even gotten calls from people outside of the United States mm-hmm. because they've read about how blacks are being treated here, and they want to know more about what the Methodist Church has to say, what the black church has got to say. So we serve as a resource for the students at Drew, for students all across the country, for people who are interested in doing books, and just for knowing that black Methodists still are in the Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. Many people, when they think about the Methodist Church, rarely see, until recently, more black people.
That's true. I was about to ask you about that.
You see white folks and, you know, what they did, but we have a long history of being in the church. You know probably about Richard Allen.
Yes.
And many of the Methodist preachers who left the church because they were not able to hold office.
Right.
I'll use as an example my church in Washington, D.C. We came out of Foundry Church. Foundry was established about 1900, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always members of Foundry. We were both enslaved and free people, but we were relegated to the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
We had no say in how we were to be treated, so we left Foundry and formed Asbury in 1836.
Mm.
We did not get our first black pastor until about 1870, and from Asbury, two or three other denominations, John Wesley AMEZ in Washington, D.C., was formed because they did not want to be governed by white pastors. Gordon, I just looked up this morning, Gordon was formed in 1876, and they had a black pastor from the very beginning. So that history is so important to us. And I love the work that I do. I love history. In another life, or had I started out differently, I may have been a historian, but I love history, and I feel it's so important that we as adults, we as our children, our teenagers, know that we have been there. We've always been there in spite of what was done to us by other people. We have thrived, we have persevered, and we are still here.
And we love Jesus.
And we love Jesus.
Yes, we do, y'all. Yes, we do.
We love Jesus.
Yes.
That's just a quick synopsis of what the center is. One of the questions you asked, if people can send materials to me, of course, that's a big yes. We are in the process of digitizing many of our handwritten records. One of our first members, Robert Ricks Thompson, who is in Washington, D.C., was on our board from the very beginning. And Robert was a big recorder of everything by hand. And, you know, back in 2001 when we formed, we weren't really big internet users and recorders electronically as we are today. So I went to Barbara's house maybe April or May of last year. I spent three different segments over 3 weeks gathering her material. She had recorded everything our Heritage Center had done from the very beginning in long hand. So when I finished, I think we threw out about 10 boxes of material.
Wow.
And I brought 6 boxes of materials home. I knew from 2015, from the time that I took over, that all of our records were in an electronic format. But much of that early history of our organization, of the role that blacks had in the Methodist Church, were all handwritten. You know, we Dorothy Height was a Methodist. James Lawson, who we currently see in all of the news, the late Joseph Lowry and his wife Evelyn. I mentioned Bishop Leontine Kelly. Garrett Morris was a Methodist. Elijah McCoy, Charles Tenley, who wrote many of our famous hymns, When the Storms of Life Are Raging, who was the pastor of Tenley Temple in Philadelphia, of course, was a United Methodist. So we are in the work of preserving, protecting, and promoting the history of blacks in the Methodist Church.
Well, that effort, I think, is important for multiple reasons. Are folks also sending you photos or any audio? Is that part of the
collection? Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We are receiving audio. We're receiving photographs. I have a list of what kinds of things that we will accept. I have a couple of bishops' wives who asked about their robes. Those are not the kinds of material that we are able to store effectively.
Absolutely.
But it's materials that we would love to have. About 4 or 5 years ago, Sharon, we started out recording the history of African-American bishops. We called them ebony bishops. And their wives, because we knew that while the bishop's stories were told, their wives' stories were rarely told. And you know, the wives had some stories.
Oh, yes.
So we have recorded about 40 of those, and we are working on now figuring out the best way to make those available for people to hear. All of the recordings are about an hour and an hour and a half long. And you know, in this day and age, Sharon, you know, people don't want to sit through more than a snippet.
They don't.
So we're working on a way to perhaps put some snippets of materials from from all of the recordings that we did. So if you want to hear Bishop Farr Stith, who was one of our founders, if you want to hear his interview, you can click on a button and hear just a little bit. But if you want to hear the whole thing, you can go to that. So that was really important. I was very proud of the work we did, especially around the bishops' wives. Because as I said, their stories are rarely told.
Oh, yeah.
But you know that they were behind.
Oh,
they
definitely
were the wind behind
definitely
the wind.
Amen.
Especially
say
when
it
we went to the central jurisdictions, because the people in Washington, D.C. had to travel 300 or 400 miles
absolutely
to fellowship. So that now, work is so important.
It is. Now, Carol, let me remind the audience, this is Carol Travis, and she is sharing with us about the African American Methodist Heritage Center. And this is excellent information for our listening audience, and I'm just delighted that I had a chance to hear from you today. Now, I would like to know before I bring this to an end, how is this impacting the larger United Methodist Church? Because for me, I really didn't know a lot about the United Methodist Black history, because I was born, I was raised AME, I knew all that. But I didn't know, I thought mostly United Methodists were white. And, you know, so of course, when I'm working over here by at Fisk for all these years, you know, we have Clark Memorial down the street and Gordon around the corner and two or three others I come in contact with. But are the main, are the mainstream people, the white people, are they into seeing what the Heritage Center has and what has been their comments or their thoughts about it?
Sure. Excellent question, Sharon. Thank you. Let me just say, I'm trying to think of the year that this was done. The contributions of Black Americans in the Methodist Church has been recognized. As a matter of fact, our general conference, and I may be saying it right, but let me just back up. We were given $100,000 a year for several years by the United Methodist Church to get set up, organized, and to move forward. Which was a tremendous help for us to get started. We are still partially funded by one of the United Methodist organizations. We also have gotten contributions from white Methodists. We are recognized as one of the official ethnic groups of the United Methodist Church. We also have others that have come along after us. Marcha, which speaks to the Hispanic experience in the Methodist Church. But we're recognized as one of the six caucuses of the United Methodist Church that is speaking for the Methodists. And that's the Black Methodist for Church Renewal. That's the parent organization from which we came. So I would say, yes, we are a part of the church. We are seen more in prominent places. 4 years ago, we elected 8 Black bishops in the Methodist Church, 4 women, which was the first time ever that 4 women were elected to head major jurisdictions in our United Methodist Church.
So
Carol, I would say,
Carol, knowing what you said about all the people, the information that's in there, are the white United Methodists, are they paying attention? Do they see? Are they participating in? Do they visit? And, you know, I'm sure that you all do an excellent job at telling them what it is in the center. But, you know, we need for them to know about our history and not just the other way around. And sure. you bring out the great information that's there and the folks that are there. But in order for all of God's children, to the black ones and the white ones and everyone else to know about this, I just have in my heart and soul a thought that they should really want to know more too, to become more educated on the subject. And that, I mean, if we're supposed to love one another, isn't that part of the process?
Oh, absolutely, Sharon. Let me just say that, yes, I see more and more of this, mm-hmm. More and more of this happening. Of mm-hmm. course, we're going to always have people who mm-hmm. will resist what is coming down the pike. The right. United Methodist Bishops, and we have bishops, black, white, we have bishops from all over, mm-hmm. Of all races and genders. And the Council of Bishops is our governing body. But I see an understanding, and I see measures being taken to ensure that all God's children are seen equal.
Amen.
We have just mounted a campaign, well, and I really don't want to say a campaign, a ministry effort across the United Methodist mm-hmm. Church to dismantle racism. Mm.
Amen.
And all of the bishops have charged their conferences and their members to work on dismantling racism. Mm. Let me just say quickly what I know for
bless
sure
the
that
Lord.
We've done in the Washington, D.C. area. My church, Asbury, came out of Foundry United Methodist Church, which is primarily still a white church.
Mm-hmm.
Asbury Foundry and John Wesley, which is the black church that came out of Asbury because they could not have black pastor then.
Mm-hmm.
We have been working in a partnership for the last 3 or 4 years. We do pulpit exchanges. We do book studies together. We're in and out of each other's churches. Mm-hmm. We were in and out of each other's churches quite a bit before COVID came. And I know that those efforts are going on throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
I see them. I hear about them every single day.
Excellent.
We publish a United Methodist Digest, I guess, for want of a better term, which has stories of everything that's going on in the church. I believe that's how you found out about us, because we just published a story about the 20-year history
yes.
of the African American Methodist Heritage Center, and I've gotten just about a query just about every week, 2 or 3 a week, and many of them are from white churches.
Okay.
So, Carol, please
well,
tell
amen,
me how
Lord.
I can find
thank
out.
You. Amen, Jesus. Amen.
Yes.
Because
yes.
we always have to do it. We always have to do the work. And I'm like, no. This is not right, y'all. This is not. We don't want to work all our lives and then have to work all of our lives. We need some help out here. And I'm glad. That makes me feel so much better. Now, I have to, I'm running out of time, but Carol, I knew I could just, me and you could just talk, okay? I knew. And, Carol, for people to find out more about the African American Methodist Heritage Center, or if they themselves have something that might be of archival purposes, what is the best thing to do?
Okay, let me give you our email address. Our email address is A like Apple, M like Mary, H like Henry, C like Charles, at AOL.com.
Hmm.
I'll say it again, AAMHC@AOL.com. I will give you my cell phone number. We have an office number, but in this age of everything being virtual, the best way to reach me is to call me directly on my cell phone, and I'll be happy to give you that. That is 301-908-6501. 301-908-6501. We also have a web page. Our web page is aamhc space on there that you could read. You can read more about us. There's a place there that you may make donations mm-hmm. to us if you see fit. There's also a contact on there that you may list your name and number. That information comes directly to me. Mm-hmm. We, as I mentioned, we do have an office number, but if you want to get me directly right away,
okay.
the best place to reach me is at my cell.
Excellent. Carol, this was fabulous information. I feel very blessed this morning hearing from you. Carol Travis, she is with the African American Methodist Heritage Center. And during this Black History Month or any month, please go to their website, aamhc-umc.org, or just do a little search and it won't take you much to be able to come up with the link on that. And I thank you so much. And now you and I have each other's contact.
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, you keep me posted on the project.
And, oh, I will.
Yeah,
I made a new friend.
Yes, ma'am, you have, certainly have. And I do, this morning, I want to say, I would be remiss if I didn't say good morning to Pastor Paula Smith of Gordon Memorial United Methodist Church. She has been on my roundtables, pastors' roundtables before, and has participated in my Women at the Cross show, and is a supporter of WFSK. So, good morning, Pastor Smith, and the Gordon family, and all the United Methodist families that are listening, both in Nashville, and of course online at WFSKFM.org. Carol, you have blessed our day, and I thank you so much for your time, and of course your work for the community of faith.
Thank you, Sharon.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.